Thank you for being here. I was just thinking while we sang two songs that we probably sing as often, as frequently as we sing any other songs in our hymn book. I don't know if we sing these songs too often or if we sing them not often enough. Because I think that, and I appreciate Brother Godwin choosing them, because we need to be a heaven-centered people. We need to be focused on future things. And I fear that we are not. I fear that I am not. Maybe it'd be a better way to put it. I fear that our life here on earth, in our own circumstances, in my own circumstances, are so comfortable and so convenient that we don't look for heaven. That we are, although we would deny it, we're essentially looking for heaven here. And that is a problem. That is a real problem. This evening, I want to talk about a mentality that I see among many Christians. The idea that the perfect life is not only achievable, but it's one piece away. Maybe for you the piece is marriage or children. Maybe it is finishing college or finishing high school. Maybe it is a good paying job and a good career. There are all kinds of things that we aim for. And it's very easy for us to convince ourselves, if I just had that one thing, if I could just fill that one hole, that one gap in my life, I'd be so happy. My life would be just perfect. And the tragedy behind this kind of mentality, one tragedy, is that we give up the possibility of finding happiness where we are. We essentially say, I'm not capable of being fulfilled. I'm not capable of being satisfied right now. I need this other thing. And to make things even worse, the other thing that we need usually is largely or perhaps even wholly outside of our own control. And you can see why that would lead to despair, that would lead to dissatisfaction, disgruntlement, even anger in our lives. Because not only are we missing the piece that supposedly is going to give us everything that we want, we cannot find that piece. Or having found it, we can't claim it for ourselves. I personally, as is oftentimes the case with these kind of cultural problems, I blame Hollywood for this. Ladies, you know, if you like the romantic comedies, rom-coms, you're very accustomed to the notion of this person, usually a woman, who has a pretty good life. Everything seems to be pretty settled, and there's usually it's a man. She doesn't have a man, and so 110, 120 minutes later, or whatever, she gets her man, and now she's happy. And they roll the credits, and happily ever after, everything's great. She got what she absolutely had to have. And isn't it such a beautiful story? For male movies, it's much the same thing, except instead of the perfect woman, it's usually revenge against our enemies or something involving guns. We train ourselves in this way to think that the perfect life is possible. Possible here, and it's not. And I want to deal with that for a little bit. I want to talk a little bit about the nature of life here on earth. I want us to break away from this notion that life is some kind of puzzle to be put together and to eventually be complete in this life. I'm a jigsaw puzzle guy. I have a closet full of jigsaw puzzles, and I like putting them together, and the idea, of course, is if you buy a 1,000-piece puzzle or a 2,000, whatever your hankering is, that there's going to be a certain number of pieces in that
puzzle, and they all have their place, and there's not going to be any extras, and there's certainly not going to be any left over, and so everything fits in its place, and then you got the whole thing laid out in front of you. And we think that's what life is, that life is just about getting everything assembled in the right kind of way. But I want to emphasize to you that in this life, perfection is unattainable. You are not going to be able to put your life together in a perfect kind of symbiosis, sort of. It just doesn't work that way. Not in this life. And because we think that we can do better, because we think that this perfect life is out there, we complain. Because, after all, we're entitled to the perfect life, and we don't have the perfect life. We can see it on the horizon, but we can't quite get there. Problem is that if it were attainable, if it were possible, you wouldn't be worthy of the honor anyway. I don't want to be mean about this, but what makes you think you deserve a perfect life? Or let me back up a little bit. How many people do you know that have perfect lives? Oh, I know a lot of people that have perfect lives. Oh, sure. That woman over there with the happy family and the happy life and the great career, and she's got a perfect life. And this fellow over here that's making all the money, and he's got perfect life or whatever. Well, I would encourage you, if you are of that mentality, if you have a person in mind, if you think that way, go over to that person today or tomorrow or next week or whatever and tell them about their perfect life and watch them laugh in your face and have them try to explain to you that, in fact, their life is not perfect. And I want you to listen to them, because they're going to be telling you the truth. It is a fact that I've been accused of having a perfect life. And sometimes, in brief, fleeting moments, I feel like I do have a perfect life. I've got a lot of things going for me. I'm not going to apologize for that. But I have my problems. I have issues. Some of them very serious. Some of them keep me up at night. Some of them bring tears to my eyes. They're serious issues in my life that I wrestle with. Some of them I may share with you, some of them I may not. But I have problems just like everybody else does. Everybody has it. What makes you think that you're going to be an exception to this? What makes you so special? I want to get in line for the perfect life. I think I'm entitled to it as much as anybody else is. Fact is, none of us really deserves happiness the way that we're talking about here. And by searching for this perfect life here, as we were reading in Romans chapter 8 a few moments ago, not only do we find frustration in this life, but also we hinder our efforts to find heaven. This groaning that Paul writes about in Romans chapter 8 is given to us on purpose. It's not that God wants us to be miserable. It's not that God wants us to be incomplete. But he does want us to look for something better, not in this life. We ourselves, he says in verse number 23, groan within ourselves, waiting eagerly for our adoption as sons, the redemption of our body. We're living in hope, he says. We want something else, something different, something entirely different. And we have our hopes and expectations attached to something that is greater than simply some kind of physical problem being fulfilled in this life. Some shortcoming, some surplus, whatever it happens to be, being taken care of in this life. I want you to stretch higher than that. And I want you to appreciate that your failure to reach for those things is contributing to your negative attitude in this life. In a weird, twisted sort of way, your belief that you can have a perfect life is keeping you from having a satisfactory life. Let me illustrate this for you. This is election season, right? Let's imagine that you're running for office. For whatever reason, you might want to do that. Let's say you're running for mayor of Pensacola. And you put the signs out in people's yards, and you knock doors, and you get on the radio, and do all the things that candidates do. And come election day, you're in your political headquarters, and you're listening to the radio, and you got the TV on, and your advisor, your political advisor, comes in and tells you that the last precinct has just checked in, and you have won 51% of the vote. You've won the election. What happens? What do you do? Well, you throw a party, right? Outstanding. Let's break out the kazoos and whatnot. Throw the confetti. Well, open up the sparkling grape juice and all that kind of stuff, right? We won. That's what we're looking for. 51% of the vote. How outstanding is that? Thousands and thousands of people signing on for our vision of Pensacola. Isn't that great? Let me revise this a little bit. What would happen if the same exact thing happened, but when the fella came in to give you the results, he didn't say that you won 51% of the vote. He said you won 99.99% of the vote. What would you do then, after you woke up from your fainting spell? Well, you'd have the party, right? You'd just, unbelievable. Are you kidding me? That's unprecedented. I mean, short of some kind of vote in a communist dictatorship, nobody ever gets this kind of vote. How could you possibly get, that's amazing. Yeah, that's right. Three people in the entire county didn't vote for you. 30,000 to three. The biggest whitewash in the history of whitewashes. Wow. For 5, 10 minutes, maybe an hour, whatever, you're just in love with yourself. You just think this is the greatest thing ever, right? And then at some point, it happens. You get that look across your face. Now, wait a minute. Three people didn't vote for me? What three people? Can we get names for these people? Why didn't they vote for me? See, where were we when you got 51% of the vote? Because you didn't think perfection was attainable. But now, all of a sudden, perfection is just in your sights. Who are these people? Well, you ran against somebody. He probably didn't vote for you. Okay, that's one. And he's married, right? Okay, that's two, probably. Well, who's that last person? Do you know his name? No, I don't know. Can you find his name? Please? I mean, is it my neighbor? I mean, my sprinkler hits his truck sometimes when it's passing. That kind of annoys him. I didn't think it was that big of a deal, but maybe it's a big deal. Maybe that's it. Maybe this teacher, I had a conference with my daughter's teacher at school, and I commented about his shirt, and he didn't especially care for it, I thought he took it as a joke, but maybe not. Maybe he's been holding resentment for 20 years against me or something. You know, I gotta know. Why are we doing that? We're doing that because we think perfection is attainable all of a sudden. We're making ourselves miserable because of circumstances that are actually better than they were in the other circumstance. Well, I want us to break ourselves of that habit. Quit the notion of life being some kind of perfectible situation. And instead look at life being simply an opportunity. That you are given a certain number of days in this life. And you are blessed with a certain amount of possessions and opportunities in that life. And what we need to do is find a way to rejoice in what we have. And quit being caught up in the things that we don't have. Job is a great example of this. A great man who, in a matter of hours, goes from the one who has everything to the one who has nothing. And his attitude is oftentimes held up as the attitude that we should have. Naked I came into this world, naked I shall return. The Lord has given, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. This is not about how much I have or how much I do not have or how much I want. This is about serving God wherever we happen to be. That's what our life is here. Our life is an opportunity for us to serve God, for us to put Him first and pursue His things instead of our own things. I'd like to refer you to 2 Corinthians chapter 9 and look at what this idea of contentment can and should do for us. In this context, he's talking about the collection that's being taken up for the needy saints that the Corinthians had committed themselves to and had not especially followed through with that. He says that the one who sows sparingly is going to reap sparingly. The one who sows bountifully will reap bountifully in verse 6. He says in verse 7, each one must do as he's purposed in his heart, not grudgingly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. Now look at verse 8. And God is able to make all grace abound to you, so that always having all sufficiency in everything, you may have an abundance for every good deed. Now, that's an interesting phrase there. God is determined to give you what you need so that you will be equipped to do what you need to do. So that you will be equipped for service. Now, this has applications regarding your finances, but not just that. God wants you to be blessed in this life because He has a plan for you in this life. Now, What you may want to do more than anything else is give $1 million to charity. You think that would just be the greatest thing in the world, the bee's knees. If you could just give $1 million, if only God would give me an opportunity to give $1 million to charity, that would be so great. Well, maybe it would. And maybe one of these days that's what he'll do for you. But wouldn't it be a better use of our time to focus on what we do have in front of us, right in our hands, in our wallets, in our homes, and find a way to glorify God and serve our society, serve our neighborhood, serve our brethren with what we have, rather than dreaming about what we would do if we had something else? That's what contentment can and should be doing for us. Work with what you have. Don't imagine what you would do if you had more. I find myself thinking about this sometimes. What would I do if I had $1 million? Or what would I do if I got a big raise? Or what I would do if this, that, or the other? And that's not necessarily wasted time. But a better use of our time, a better use of our energy, is looking at what we are doing with what we have. Now, see, we have tried to transition a little bit away from the idea of what is right or wrong with your life in terms of personal things. What you have that you don't want, what you don't have that you do want, or whatever. Let's kind of break away from that way of looking at our life, instead focusing on what kind of opportunities are mine, where I am right now, with what I have right now. Is there a way that I can be of use to somebody else? Is there a way that I can glorify God in some way with what I have right now? Now, do you see how much more of a practical consideration that is than what might happen with what I might get at some undetermined period in the future? What we need to do is accept where we are, including our shortcomings, including our lacks. And I suggest to you that if you will abandon this notion of plugging in the pieces, if you'll abandon the notion of if I only had this, or if I only had that, or if I only could lose this other thing, if you will get away from striving for perfection, in fact, if you would get to the point where you realize you'll never have the perfection, that will free you up to find joy in the present, where you are with what you have. I feel strongly on this subject. I've been thinking along these lines a great deal in recent months, and I hope that I'm communicating with this accurately and effectively here. Because I see a great deal of discontent among people in general in our country, and that includes my brethren. And I really think that this is a problem with us in America, that we've had so many wonderful things happen to us, and we think that somehow we are entitled to other wonderful things. More, the handful, small handful of wonderful things that we have not been given over these years. I think that if you were to bring somebody from 600 years in the past and have you try to explain to them your problems, your issues that you have in this life, I can't afford my medicine. Medicine? What's medicine? You mean you can treat this disease? That's amazing. My father died of that disease when he was 31. We have such unbelievable opportunities and blessings in this life. It would be a tragedy. It would be a failure of faith, really, for us to suggest that somehow or another, God has not given us enough for us to be what he wants us to be. He has given us more than we need. As Brent oftentimes prays, an infinite amount more than we deserve. And that's absolutely right. If we can break away from this notion, I think that you're going to find that you are liberated to find a great deal more joy in your life than you have found prior to this time. Now, let me suggest one other thing, and then the lesson will be yours. If there is a hole in your life, if there is some particular thing that is absent or that is wrong,
Maybe it's a health thing. Maybe it's a friends thing. Maybe it's a family thing. Maybe it's a money thing or whatever. If there is something remarkably prominent in your life that is keeping you from having the life or the lifestyle that you want, instead of trying to find that individual thing, whatever it happens to be, finding the health, finding the family, finding the money, whatever, instead of trying to plug that hole with that thing, try plugging that hole with faith. Try coming around to the idea that this is lacking in my life, and I really very much wish that it were not. But I am in the hand of a loving and powerful God who has gotten people in worse shape than me through worse circumstances than I will ever be able to imagine. And he can and will get me through this also if I will trust in him. It's better for us to trust God for our lives than trust some better future version of ourselves. If only I could grow into such and such a situation, if only I could get enough experience for this promotion or what, why don't we trust in God instead? What does the writer here, Paul or whoever it is, in Hebrews tell us? Hebrews chapter 13, and verse number 5 and 6. And he mentions money specifically, and that's maybe appropriate because so many of our problems in this life would get so much better, would they not, if we just had a little bit more money. That's the cure to retirement. That's the cure to health. That's the cure to education. It's the cure for everything, right? Just a little more money. God, through the pen of the inspired writer, tells us in verse 3, make sure that your character is free from the love of money, being content with what you have, for he himself has said, I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you, so that we will confidently say, the Lord is my helper, I will not be afraid. What will man do to me? You know, if circumstances in our nation got to the point where the government just broke into banks and took people's money, the more the merrier, as much as they possibly could, for whatever purpose they might want to do that, including simply to punish people who have money. If such were to happen in this life, it would not be the first time it ever happened. Jesus encourages us in the Sermon on the Mount to store up for ourselves treasures that are in heaven instead of the treasures that are on the earth where moth eats away and that rust corrodes and thieves break through and steal. That's the way it is with things in this life. Money will let you down from time to time. Even in America, where our currency is relatively stable. There are places in this world where they have papered their walls with money because that's how much it was worth. In our country, that's not the case, or hasn't been anyway, for most of our country's history. But even in our country, we can definitely imagine circumstances where whatever amount of money you may have, however much there may be, it's going to be of no use to you. Remember Gilligan's Island? You know, Mr. Howell had all the money, right? Was he that much better off than Gilligan and the skipper and all them? What difference does it make? Money will fail you. And so therefore, it may not be the best notion for us to look to money as being the solution. Why not instead look to God? Because God tells us, I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you. If God is our helper, then we do not need to be afraid. There's nothing for us to be afraid of. I caution you, if your toes are getting a little bit sore here this evening, I'm not aiming for any particular person, but maybe you've been trusting yourself a little bit too much. Maybe you've been a little bit disgruntled about this life. Maybe you haven't had enough faith or whatever. And your entire hope has been rested in the notion that one of these days it's just bound to get better. Well, maybe it will. I don't know. That'd be nice. I hope so, for your sake. But it is entirely possible that it will not get better. It very well may get worse, such has been the case in times past. For me, maybe for other people here as well, where we thought that we had absolutely gotten to the bottom of the barrel, and then, you know, somebody sets off a blast charge and we find new depths to plumb after all of this. It happens sometimes. Jeremiah's warned about this. We studied Jeremiah in the auditorium in the last quarter, and Jeremiah's whining a little bit and disgruntled, and he's not being treated very well. And God tells him something interesting in chapter 12, and verse number 5, where he says that if you are, well, let me put it in his words instead of trying to paraphrase. Jeremiah is frustrated, as you and I would be frustrated, at the circumstances. Why are things not going any better than they are? And God, instead of saying, it's okay, Jeremiah, it's all right, hang in there, relief is coming, it's right around the corner. If you can just bear with me for a few more weeks, a few more months, it'll be all right. Things are going to turn around, I promise you. God doesn't tell him that. He says in verse number 5, if you have run with footmen and they have tired you out, then how can you compete with horses? If you fall down in a land of peace, how will you do in the thicket of the Jordan? What he's saying here basically is, you ain't seen nothing yet. You need to get tough. You need to bear down here basically, because your problems have only started. Jeremiah has 51 chapters in it, not 13. And it's not written especially in chronological order, but you understand the point that I'm making here. Things are going to get worse for Jeremiah before they get better. And that may be the case in our life. We don't know. And certainly there are ample reasons for us to wish that were not the case. But if it is the case, isn't it a better investment of our time and energy and effort to equip ourselves to deal with our current circumstances rather than just kind of hang by our fingernails thinking that surely in the next few days, in the next few weeks, it's going to change? Find your faith. Find your connection to God where He can get you through this. The endurance that you build up now in these tough times may be exactly what you need to get you through even tougher times that are coming in the future. I try to avoid giving advice to people like, you know, it's bound to get better. You know, it won't be like this forever. Because I don't know the future. I don't know what's going to happen. What we need to be praying for is faith. What we need to be praying for is patience. James says in James 1 verse 2, consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. And let endurance have its perfect result, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. Maybe God is trying to work with you to develop some part of your character that is lacking. Now, if you go to a physical therapist and you know you broke your arm and you're trying to build it back up again, the physical therapist is not going to be very interested in you showing off all the muscles that you have that do work. That's just not pertinent to the situation. She's interested, he's interested in working on the muscles that don't work. And it's a lot more painful to work on those muscles. It's awful. But we do it because we realize that there is an end result, ultimately, that we're trying to reach. And that's what God is trying to work in us. And it may be that you dealing with your thorn in the flesh, as it were, is going to equip you for the task that God has in mind for you. What we need to remember above all else is that as we are suffering, as we are struggling, as our life is letting us down, as we are not getting out of it what we think we need or deserve, that Jesus is there to carry us through. Paul writes to us in Philippians chapter 4, and verse 11, not that I speak from want, for I have learned to be content with whatever circumstances I am. I know how to get along with humble means, and I know also how to live in prosperity. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of being filled and going hungry, both of having abundance and suffering need. I can do all things through Him who strengthens me. Now, if you're like me, you don't need nearly as much help, in your own mind anyway, with learning how to deal with prosperity as you do help with dealing with adversity. I think that I think I'm fairly good at handling good times. And maybe I'm asking for some trouble saying this out loud. I don't know. But it strikes me that most of us probably need more help with the negative side than the positive side. If that is the case, then should we complain? Should we fuss? Should we lodge official protests when God gives us opportunities to work on the things that we need to work on? If, in fact, we need to be better at going hungry, if we need to be better at getting along with humble means, surely it is a blessing from God to allow us to suffer in this way. I realize, and trust me, I'm right there with you, it doesn't feel like a blessing at the time. Discipline rarely does. But as God gets us away from this notion of finding comfort in this life, and instead gets us toward this notion of finding purpose in this life, finding meaning in this life, finding faith in this life, I think we can perhaps break ourselves of this notion that what I need in this life is this, or what I need is that, or what I need is something else. What you need is God. What you need is Jesus. And if you have that, as Jeremiah says in the Lamentations, the Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore, I will hope in him. If you have the Lord, you find that you don't need anything else. And what a wonderful place that would be for us to have the absolute confidence that no matter what's going on in our life, no matter what we have, what we don't have, Jesus is Lord, not only of heaven and earth, but he's Lord of my own personal life. And whatever circumstance I may run across in this life, whatever I have or do not have, Jesus will fill the holes for me and help me find contentment regardless of what I have or do not have. That's my prayer for my life, and it's my prayer for your life also. If God chooses to bless you in this life, bless you more than he has blessed you in the past, that's fine. That's great. And hopefully we can use those circumstances to his glory and not just to our own. But whatever the future has for us, whatever the present has for us, it's not nearly so much a matter of how much you have or how much you want. It's a matter of, are you a Christian? Are you serving God? Are you committing yourself to him and to his cause in this life? Is that where your life really is? Hidden with Christ in God, as Paul writes in Colossians chapter 3, first few verses there. We have died and our life is hidden with Christ in God, he says. Well, if that is not the case in your life, if your life has not yet ended, if you have not yet begun your new walk with Christ, we encourage you to make that right. We don't come to Jesus because he makes our life easy. We come to Jesus because he gives our life meaning, because he gives us purpose, because he gives us hope. And it may be that your life in this world gets more complicated, more painful, more difficult because you come to Jesus. I don't mean that to sound like I'm trying to deter you from coming to the Lord. But to realize, it's not about what you have in this life. It's about what Jesus can do for you. And about the next life that is waiting for us after this one is over. If you are ready to give your life over to Jesus, if you, in some way, some spiritual way, you've fallen short and you need help from brothers and sisters in Christ in any way necessary, please respond to the invitation while we stand and sing to encourage you this time.